Yes, guys, what's good? You're tuned into Mango Masala, Pi Radio South Asian show. My name's Gerns, I'm here with Halima.
Hello, everybody. Hello, hello.
And Halima's currently showing her flag expertise yet again. Like, if you don't know, Pi Radio for the past year has basically had all the world flags listed around, and every time Halima's here, she's always like, that one's that one.
It is like a hyperfixation. I've spoke about it on the show before, right? Like, I'm like obsessed, like in a very, very neurodivergent hyperfixation kind of way. Like, I am very obsessed with like flags and maps and things of that sort. Languages, actually, recently I've been really into like watching videos where people talk in a native language and like guessing what language that is. I'm really quite good at it, not gonna lie.
Yeah. What, actually guessing the language?
Yeah, just like they're talking in their native language and you have to, no cues, just guess. Yeah.
It's like GeoGuessr, but like for languages.
Oh my God, I spoke about GeoGuessr, yeah. I'm sick of that game, guys.
Also, every time you turn to me, like, you can't hear you in the mic, so.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm just engrossed in conversation with Carlos, that's what it is. I forget that
word.
Can't
help it.
I know, I can't. Yeah, that's good social manners.
Yeah, it is.
Like, I always look at people that I'm speaking to.
Yes, very good. But also, we did find out a couple of weeks ago that you don't really need a mic anyway.
True.
I mean, we post on our socials, and speaking of socials, have you seen like one of our clips recently? Is like gone like mega viral.
What? Which one?
The one of us talking about that burglary that went wrong.
Oh, I look disgusting in that.
I mean, you don't look disgusting. You've just woken up a bit.
Which I did, but I looked. You know what? You know, I couldn't even look at it.
You know what? It's a weird feeling though, because it's gone relatively viral.
All the ones that I look good in, they can't be.
Oh, not on that on Instagram.
Oh, for God's sake, guys! Like, I'll really be like.
Yeah, but it's weird because. It's a weird feeling because obviously this clip is like getting loads of attention, but then obviously I'm glad that we've still got our commentary.
Oh, for God's sake, is this the most likes we've ever had? And this is what
on Instagram, yeah.
Nearly 11k likes,
nearly 250,000 views, basically.
Oh, guys,
There is a thing though, right? Halima, if you really looked that bad, there would have been one comment that had said it, and none of the comments are saying anything.
I know, like, girls can relate. Like, I'm one of those girls that I'm either, like, completely bummy or, like, I'm done up, right? And, like, there's just no in-between for me. Like, Carlos, you'll know. If I'm at home, I'm looking bummy. Like, I've not brushed my hair. I might not even have washed my face.
You know,
like,
what the thing is as well? I feel like it translates into your delivery as well. Because I also feel like when you're... I don't know if it's because of that or whether it's just linked. But every time that you're not, like, glammed up, I also feel like you kind of go into the... Hey, guys.
I'm a bit... that's because when I'm not, it's because I'm, like, either tired or I'm not feeling too well that day. Like, that's why. But I am either, like, completely bummy or, like, very glammed up. And when I'm looking bummy and I'm walking around, and I just think to myself, like, God, if only you lot knew what I could look like.
Well, gosh. It's kind of fun being able to catfish people a bit, I suppose.
That is so annoying. Our most, like by far, our most viral clip.
Yeah.
And that's what I look like. Why did that go so viral?
I don't know. It just hit the algorithm right. But, like, I have realised that I think the clips of us recently that have got a lot of attention is where it's we're reacting to a clip. Which is why it's a weird feeling, like I'm saying, because obviously that clip has gone relatively viral and it's like, okay, good, like the platform is getting lots of attention drawn towards it, but I'm also like, it's not really one of the clips that, especially that one, it doesn't really encapsulate what we're really about. Because it's not anything to do with being Asian. I mean, it is like kind of a funny British thing, which I suppose like is semi us, but it's like, it's not really
Our most meaningful content.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why it's a weird feeling, because it's like, obviously I'm grateful for like getting attention and stuff, but then also I'm like,
how does that translate then afterwards?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like a really, you know what? We interview like so many influencers and content creators, like, we never really speak about it from our perspective of, like, being Mango Masala, do we? But, like, it's true, like, that this is a conversation that we're always having, like, beyond, behind the scenes, like, of, in terms of, like, how to grow and expand and like, scale our platform. Yeah. And it is true, like, you kind of have, the way that the algorithm and social media is set up is, like, you can have, like, one really viral video, and if the rest of your kind of content is kind of consistent with that type of video, I think that will lend you to grow your brand, because people then come to your page and they'll like, do you know what I mean? Like, they're already interested in what you've posted. Whereas for us, like, how do we translate that then into kind of like increased engagement when the rest of our content isn't, like, we do things like that, but not, that's not kind of more, most consistently what we're putting out.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad, because there was a point like a couple of years ago where I was kind of like, oh, should we just start sharing other people's content? Like, purely that. Like, and to try and get attention. But I'm glad that we don't do that. I'm glad that it's still, like, us. It's, like, our takes in it rather than that, because I just feel like you're kind of, like, stealing other people's content then, you know what I mean? And it is just purely for the sake of clout rather than, like, actually being anything
meaningful. Like, people, there are like, Instagram, TikTok accounts. I mean, it's like, I'm Just Bae and, like, all of these pages that are literally, like, the whole point of them, and they do numbers. It's just a repost page. Yeah. Like, it's just a repost,
but,
like...
I mean, but that's the thing as well, that is... Also, it serves the purpose. Like, it's not like I'm Just Bae is trying to be, like, anything, like, meaningful or,
trying to
engage anyone social, politically, or whatever.
That is how they're categorizing themselves.
But
true.
For us, like, I would like to think that people who know us see us as a means for promoting positive social change and whatever. So,
yeah, insightful commentary.
Yeah. So, that being said, yeah, I think it's... No, I think, like... Like I'm learning, like from this, like, okay, well, that seems to do well, so maybe we should do, like, more of those in the future sort of thing. But at the same time, if anyone's worried that we're going down the meme, like, page route, I can guarantee you that is not what we want to do. And if you've seen that clip on our socials as well, and you're like, oh, like, that's a bit, like, whatever, like, yeah. That trust me, like, you might see a couple of them, like, over the course of the next however long that Mango Masala goes on, but I'm not trying to turn us into that. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Just diversifying our product, guys.
Yeah. And also, it's nice to also, because it was something that's, like, it was funny. Do you know what I mean? Even though, like, one of the... I was actually worried at the start, because one of the first comments was, like, how is it funny he pulled a knife on her? And I was just like...
Well, she didn't care, did she?
Yeah,
she
exactly.
wasn't scared.
Obviously, that's not funny, and we're not
you
encouraging people
to act like
that. You
can't take paracetamol for someone else's headache. The woman doesn't give one.
Yeah, exactly. Like, lighten up a bit.
Innit?
Yeah. That being said, obviously, like, we can't, as no matter how hard we try, we can't get away from our roots, so.
Bad Vibes Island.
Oh my God. The thing is that I'm sat next to him in the studio, and, like, if I look over, I can see very palpably, like, the strain in his voice. It's quite terrifying.
You know what?
I'm sure you're going to tell me.
No. You know what I was thinking the other day? I was listening to, what's it called? You know, Knock You Down? Kerry Hilson, and I was just thinking about that, and I was thinking about, like, I was listening to the, like, neo part and, like, feeling myself kind of thing, and I was like, oh, this would be a really good, like, trio karaoke song. And then obviously the first trio that I think of is
come on.
I was like, I imagine you doing the Kerry Hilson part, meaning the neo part, and then Simran comes out to do Kanye, obviously,
except I would actually do all of it,
right?
Like, this is how I know, like, you kind of know me to know that I would love to do karaoke, but then also, like, you really fall short in assuming that I would let anyone have the spotlight other than me.
No, but you don't know, also don't know who you're talking about. I think I've spoken before.
No.
About how, no. At Christmas, my friend Sachin did, like, a Christmas party, and I hosted a quiz for it, and it went down swimmingly, and I was, like, really, like, happy with myself. Like, I proper got the crowd involved. I was like, yes, I'm doing, like,
I think
also it is because of, like, obviously over the past, like, years, I've, like, become so much more comfortable doing presenting, and then I was, like, doing that, and I was like yes, I've read the crowd, like, I'm on a roll. And then they went straight into karaoke, and then I'd had a couple of drinks, and let's just say, like, I was to the point where I looked back at videos and what people were saying, and I was actually being rude. Like, there's videos of people doing karaoke, and I'm like getting up to like go and do the next song, and my friends literally grab me like, sit down, like don't be like, and I'm just like, who's this person singing this song? Like, who are they? Like, I'm just like, yeah. So the next karaoke thing I went to after that, which was also for another friend's birthday, I was very much like, I need to redeem myself.
Right, your party next week, we're having a karaoke off.
Yeah.
You know, we have mics. We have multiple mics in my home.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a joke. Like, every week, that's what we do.
We've heard about your dad as well, haven't I? Like...
Me and my sisters, we go out specifically on drives to do carpool karaoke.
Yeah.
Like...
See, I think that would be me if I had the time and wasn't spending all my time editing Mango Masala.
Oh, whatever.
See, you just turn up for 2 hours, not even every week, say your £2 to go out for like 2 weeks.
Guys,
and go do whatever.
I actually do need to learn. Like, I'm awful. Like, you know what? I was trying to... So I have like a travel page on TikTok. And in true ADHD fashion, I'll post like 4 videos at once and then not post again in like 6 months.
Yeah, I have noticed that.
And then come back and post like 4 videos at once and then not post again. And like, I it's because I just find like editing so tedious. I just can't. So, you know, when I got my hair done a few weeks ago, I tried to do like a TikTok transition and it took all three of my sisters and my friend 30 minutes to kind of teach me just how to film this transition.
I'm not gonna lie though, I'm not a major fan of on phone editing. Like TikTok, I find it really
how do you
difficult.
Do it then?
No, I find it really difficult. Like, you know, like so when we did the Nobody Knows Me, like you do that one, I used TikTok for that. And that was like the first time in I don't know how long that I've actually done like a TikTok edit. And I found it difficult.
What do you usually do then?
I just do it on I've got Adobe Premiere, so I just use.
You know
that.
What? Maybe that's what I'll start doing because I need to. I've just been thinking like I need to start putting my. I have so much like travel content
spend
on my
like,
phone.
£50 a month on it though. Yeah.
For God's sake.
There's no else. You know what? They really Adobe like the software is great, but they really do have you in a chokehold because it used to be like back in the day when you know you buy like CD-ROMs and you would like just use that. I remember like my uncle got it me when I was like really young and that's part of how I got into like doing it then. And then I didn't use it for a while. I used like free iMovie and stuff because obviously it's just there. But iMovie is very limited in what you can do.
Is there not a free version of Adobe?
Well, there are bootleg versions out there. Obviously, we're not endorsing people to go and get them. But they are also quite buggy. Like they'll like break a bit. But yeah, it's £50 for like all the Adobe stuff. Like it's like, so I could do Photoshop, Illustrator.
What if I just want to edit videos?
Well, you probably can get it for a bit cheaper just for that. But
oh, for God's
but
sake,
this is what I mean though. Back in the day, it used to be you could just buy the CD-ROM a one-off, and then that's however much you used to do it. But now there's literally no alternative. There's no one-in option. You have to pay that constantly, and I'm just like. It is a, like...
Ooh, 50% off all apps plan.
Okay, I would encourage you...
For the first 3 months, pay.
I would encourage you to have a really strong think, Halima, given what we've just said about how you, like, do things
for,
like,
a little... No, it's because I need to do it, though.
But...
Is it difficult to learn?
Well, this is the thing. For what you're doing, Halima, like, you've got a Mac, right?
Yeah,
I think just do it on iMovie.
Is it?
I don't think you need it necessarily.
Okay, first.
Like,
first.
And that's free, so.
See, if you wasn't there to talk me out of it, I would have just paid the money,
exactly.
Spent
like,
it,
it's
and
not,
never used it.
Yeah, it's not worth it.
See how impulsive ADHD is? Like, like right here, right now, I never heard of this thing before in my life.
Yeah.
Right here, right now, I heard about it for the first time, I just would have bought it and that's it, finished, done.
Yeah, I mean, because I use it for Mango Masala, I use it for, like, work as well. Like, it makes sense, basically. Like, that's how I justify it in my head and also, like, I put it on my...
I mean, that's literally your day job.
Yeah, I can put it on my tax return at the end of the year as well, so it's like...
Yeah.
It feels like I'm getting money back, like, at the end of it.
But,
anyway, we've gone on a massive tangent there because of my singing, basically. going back to Bad Vibes Island, we did
but
like
I
a...
completely forgot we even played that jingle.
We did like a Bad Vibes Island on steroids a couple of weeks ago, and honestly, it's kind of happening again.
Oh,
but like, I don't... But I need. We need to like... I can't name it Bad Vibes Island on steroids 4, like so soon after Bad Vibes on steroids 3. Anyway, yeah, there's a lot that's gone on. And with that in mind, we are going to have to like move through relatively quickly. but working our way through it, there was a vote earlier this week. MPs basically voted on whether MPs should be excluded from Parliament if they are arrested on suspicion of serious sexual or violent offences. So the current situation... If MPs should be excluded from Parliament immediately if they are arrested on suspicion of sexual or violent offences.
What's the debate?
It's whether that should
happen. My point is, what is the debate to be had?
Well, the current situation is it's only if they end up being charged, but this was moving it to if they're arrested.
Yeah, suspend them because it's that can also always be undone if the charges are not found to be true.
Exactly. And
it's better to take caution and do your due diligence than to keep someone there. Because if someone is being arrested for something, there is a good chance that they've done it, you know? Mm. And the kind of people that are in our parliament, they're not historically the kind of people that are victim to wrongful convictions, let's just say.
Well, the vote follows a number of incidents involving MPs in recent years. Well, we've seen, like, literally, I think every couple of months, what an MP is getting arrested for something or the other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, do you want to hear, so that they voted in favour, it went through.
That's the one where, what's her name, Jess?
Jess Phillips was the main instigator.
Right. She was like, there's two people in this.
Yeah, they won by one vote. It was 170 votes to 169.
Let's think from, like, there is obviously a such thing as, like, an objective morality, right? Speaking from the perspective of, in as much of an objective morality as we can have, being arrested for something, as I say, there's a likelihood that you've done it, especially if you're the kind of demographic that's in Parliament already, where, you know, you are more time protected by the law.
That's so true, actually. Now I'm thinking about it. Like, yeah, that's really true.
And if the vast majority, if almost half of the cabinet are not in favour of this, it's one of them ones where it's like, if it doesn't bother you, like, if you've got nothing to hide, then this should be a good, like, bill to put forward.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to put out any kind of speculation, but only 8 Conservative MPs actually voted in favour of this.
It's because, like, the way that I see it is that you are preempting kind of protective measures against yourself. That's the way that I see it. Like, if you are someone who, what is it, arrested for what? What kind of misconduct?
Serious offences, so sexual or violent.
Oh, okay, serious offences, cool. If you are someone who you know that, like, for example, if I was a member of cabinet and, like, they were trying to pass this law or whatever, I would be like, yeah, cool, go for it. It doesn't concern me. Because I know I'm not committing no serious offences. Mm. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, the only people that I could imagine would stand against that are the people who have committed serious offences. Logically, that's what makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the thing that you're saying as well. Like, we're not saying that it doesn't exist, that people make false claims or whatever. However, that is relatively minimal if you look at the vast scale of things. And also, of those 169 MPs that voted against this, how many of them have actually received false claims that have affected their career, realistically?
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to be that many. So Jess Phillips, obviously Labour MP, she was one of the main instigators of this, and she was quoted as saying, "Exclusion at the point of charge sends a clear message to victims that not only will we not investigate unless a victim goes to the police, but we also won't act unless they're charged, which happens in less than 1% of cases." Mm. So what's the point? So that's what you were saying, only 1% of people actually end up getting charged anyway. Mm. So it's kind of putting forward that idea that unless it goes to the next stage, then these people are going to be allowed to continue. And also, aside from this, I mean, there's two elements to it. It's whether you want to be represented in Parliament by someone who has very likely done something. Mm. And also, the people actually in Parliament, the MPs, do they want to be surrounded in this work environment by people that they know have, like, been arrested on these very serious offences?
On the contrary, I think that, in my opinion, might speak actually to a certain culture where that kind of thing maybe is acceptable, you know?
Yeah. Like, well, under these new plans, a risk assessment will take place where the clerk of the house is informed by the MP, informed by the police that an MP has been arrested on suspicion of committing such an offence. The main arguments that people had against this going through were based on, oh, it's going to allow false claims to run free and undermine procedure. But realistically,
Listen, are you not the people that are making the law? Trust in the law that you create. That's it.
Yeah. And also, I think if you looking at things like, say, from objective morality, I think it's fair enough to like let this happen. And if it does end up that like there's millions of false claims and whatever, fair enough, go back and rethink it. But I think that it outweighs, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, yeah. But also, like, why is the idea of like wrongful convictions now such a point of contention when our MPs are potentially the ones that might fall victim to it? Because my sister right now, she's a third year law student at uni. And she's obviously, like, she talks to me about the things that she's learning. And the number of miscarriages of justice that she's spoken to me about, that she's learned about, you know, in her degree. Like, this is an established thing. Like, wrongful convictions happen all the time. And dare I say it, and there are certain demographics that are more susceptible to it than others. And it's not a problem. It's not warranted any kind of criminal justice reform in our country. Mm. Now, all of a sudden, it's this huge bone of contention because our MPs might fall victim to it. If you so trust in the criminal justice system that you guys have created, that the law and order and policies and regulation that you guys have created, then trust that you will be fine if you're innocent. The same way that the rest of us have to, you know?
Yeah, I mean... On the flip side of this, whilst there have been, like I said, the majority of Conservatives have voted against this, even though it has gone through, Tories announced this week their plans to ban sex education for under 9-year-olds, as well as any form of gender identity conversation, full stop.
You know, what I find like really comical about like this whole kind of... Our government is very decisively moving further and further right of the political spectrum. That's been like very well documented. You can go online and read kind of actual established political opinions about this. And one of the kind of big talking points of the Tories has always been, Tories and Tory supporters has always been this idea of like immigration or unregulated immigration is eroding our national British culture, right? Like all the Muslim influence, the Sharia law, influence, and they're bringing their intolerance and their hate over here and blah 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 blah. And it's like the same intolerance that you think that the Muslims are bringing over here, and the same erosion of like, you know, morality and national culture that you think foreigners are imposing, it's the Tory party. It's actually the Tory party.
I really think a large part of it is scaremongering as well.
That's all it is. That's all it is. But like, it's so funny to me that like the Tory parties have made they've created this huge culture war, and they position themselves, you know, in a certain place. And when it suits them, they are traversing those boundaries of those culture wars themselves. You know, now all of a sudden they are becoming less sexually liberated, you know, they're becoming more restricted, they are censoring more and more and more.
People that are criticizing Asian communities for not integrating into British culture when it suits them.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Like, on a educational level, this is not a good thing. Like, I think when people hear the term like sex education, they get their backs up a little bit because they're like, oh my God, kids just shouldn't be, you know, exposed to any of that. They think they're talking about sex in some really crude...
They think they're sitting down kids and showing them a pornographic film.
Yeah, you know, that's like in some like really... And people assume that what that means is like they're learning about it in some crude, like really derogatory, really kind of inappropriate, explicit kind of way. That's not what that is. Sex education is literally it's a factual education on kind of bodies and changing bodies, and it's very, very important because a lot of children are not taught about it in their homes the way that maybe the parents are supposed to teach them. And what that does is they don't then understand kind of like autonomy of their own body, you know, concepts like that, and concepts of like consent and things like that. There are so many cases where, like, this is awful, but, and trigger warning, but like, so many young children have come forward to kind of talk about abuse that they were not able to articulate before because they weren't aware that, oh my God, this is like my private part and people shouldn't be in there, you know? Like, and having it, well, all it is, it's a grammar, it's a grammar of articulation. That's all it is. And it's important because they need to know their own body. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like Carla said, they're not sitting there and showing them like pornographic videos. It's an education. So I think from an educational standpoint, it is like, it's a step back. From an educational standpoint, it's a step back. Like, it is regressive. And then from this kind of like a more complex layer of this like culture war where, you know, the Tories and Tory supporters will blame one demographic for not integrating and then themselves go back into these really regressive and restricted like policies is very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, they had like the list of the what they're proposing in terms of these this various education and what age it won't be before. But the thing I find interesting is that it's risks around online gambling, scams, and why social media sites and gambling sites are age restricted. That should not be taught before year three, apparently. Yet all the other like sexual stuff and stuff to do with mental health, that has higher age restrictions, which I'm just a bit confused about why the social media gambling is allowed to be so much lower than all this other stuff. And like, it's fair, it doesn't sound that much different to what like it was when we were kids in terms of puberty and the menstrual cycle not be taught before year four, sex education in terms of conception not before year five. But I think the thing that stood out for me is in secondary school it's saying issues regarding sexual harassment, pornography, sharing or taking intimate sexual photographs without consent, that is not going to be taught before year seven. Explicit discussions regarding sexual violence, including rape and sexual assault, not before year nine.
That's kind of crazy because, like, kids are kind, like, just because you personally think that, oh, it's age inappropriate, doesn't mean that these kids are not nevertheless privy to these things. You know, kids are, especially with like social media and things like that, kids are growing up much faster than they used to. You know, even from my time and like my sister's time, we have a 12-year age gap. The generational difference between me and my sister is insane. It's crazy. And to not, it's like when people ban things and all it means is that, it doesn't mean that it goes away. It means that it opens up a black market. Mm. You know, like not teaching kids these things, not talking about them, doesn't mean that kids are not now going to be engaging in X, Y, Z. It just means that they're going to do it secretly and therefore in much more dangerous context, which will then have much more dangerous consequences.
Yeah. Like this day,
it's not common sense.
Yeah. Like this day and age, for example, the whole like taking sexual photographs. I mean, I think it's a whole dilemma that I think about in terms of my kids, whether or not they'll have a phone and whatnot, because obviously, like, I'd like to think, oh, they don't need it, but then also I'm like, I don't want to, like, if their friends have it, I'm like, whatever. But then, like, that with that in mind, the amount of kids that I see nowadays that have an iPad or whatever, or access
they're,
to
they're connected. The kids are connected, like...
From, like, in primary school, and yet they're not learning about, like, the idea that why they shouldn't take certain photos until they're in what? Yeah, not before year seven.
And also, like, what we're doing is, well, we're taking completely the idea of, like, grooming out of this. Mm. Like, I'm sorry, like, go on Facebook. Do you know how many, like paedophilia busting groups there are? Like this is, I was watching a video. It was on, like, it was on a news outlet a few months ago where it's, like, a growing epidemic in the country where civilians are taking, like, vigilante sort of action to catch paedophiles themselves because it was an interview with the police, like a chief police officer or whatever, and he was saying basically, like, local police stations are inundated with cases of grooming and paedophilia to the point where, and obviously because of police cuts and stuff like that, they can't accommodate the necessary attention for all of these cases, which means that civilians are taking vigilante action. This is obviously an issue that needs to be dealt with. If you're not teaching kids about what is and what is not sexually appropriate, about kind of the dangers of social media, the dangers of taking pictures, the what grooming may or may not be, how do you ever expect to tackle it at the root? Have as many police officers as you want, have as many vigilante groups as you want. Unless children know themselves the danger when they see it, it's going to continue. You know, like, it's not just a case of like, oh, we just don't want to teach them about sex yet. The fallout of it is so vast. It impacts so many different things. Ultimately, like, children have bodies. And even if they're not doing anything inappropriate or suspicious with it themselves, like, there's so many social and moral ills in the world where that things might be imposed on them, and they know how to identify danger. They know how they should know how to identify danger. They should know how to identify something that isn't right. And the only way that's going to happen is if you teach them, because children are innocent. They're not inherently going to know, like, especially if it's a young child, they're not inherently going to know, like, oh, you know, people should have consent before they touch me, et cetera, et cetera.
I think that's the thing, like, the idea of, like, I don't know. I think there are a lot of people out there that are, like, the type of people that hear the word sex and are immediately like, oh, my gosh, and they'll stop subjecting our kids to this, that would be like, oh, well, in my day, we did this, 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 and I turned out fine. And it's like, first of all...
Did you?
Like, if you really look back over your life, I'm sure, like, for me, for example, I'm sure there's instances, if I look back over my life, where I'm like, actually, if I'd been taught this, this, this at this age, I probably would have been,
A million percent. Like,
yeah. And also, let's say on the odd chance that you did turn out okay, good for you, but your one experience doesn't speak for, like the, if nothing bad happened to you as a child, that's great for you and I'm really happy. But at the same time, like, it, you don't speak for, like, the however many children that go through different forms of abuse at home.
Yeah, these are real issues, and they're, like, very, very prominent. Do you know what I mean? Like, this, it's not like child abuse, sexual abuse, grooming, these issues are not far and few in between. Like, statistically, I'm talking just about an example now of a police officer saying how inundated they are. You know, like, these are real life issues that need to be tackled.
Yeah. And again, yeah. And in regards to the gender identity as well, so that's not even...
That's just hateful.
Yeah, it's not even like, oh, before a certain age, it's just full stop, no conversation on gender identity.
It's just hateful, because there's, like, once again, you're, like, just acting as though the issue doesn't exist, doesn't actually seize the issue to exist. Just because you are not talking about it doesn't mean that there aren't children out there who may be confused about their gender identity or their sexual identity, who may therefore have internal... Like, we have seen time and time again, like, any time I've seen any interview with, like, you know, either a trans person or a queer person talking about their experiences, especially as a child, they talk so often about the alienation, the estrangement, the loneliness, that the confusion that they felt, to the point where there are so many children who might find, like, for example, identify as trans, that, like, unfortunately, tragically, go as far as taking their lives.
Yeah, and also to cut in there, bearing in mind that you're also not gonna let any direct references to suicide before year 8, so you're not letting them have any.
So you might create conditions in which these poor children might feel suicidal, and then not even kind of create a safe space for them to talk about it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that, like, you, just because you are not willing to talk about it, does not mean that these issues don't exist. There are children out there who are, you know, who feel a certain, like, I don't know how to say this, but, like, who may be in transitionary periods with their sexual identity or their gender identity, and they need safe spaces. Like, it is well documented. So many queer people and trans people have come forward and said that, like, I have considered suicide because of the lack of safe space, or because of, you know, the confusion or the estrangement or the loneliness that I felt because I've been made to feel like, you know, I'm wrong or I'm bad and blah, 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 blah. Like, just like, you need to understand that these people are here and they're here to stay. And, like, you can't, because essentially what you're doing is, like, you're almost to a degree, like, criminalizing those people. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, it doesn't matter what your personal sentiments are, they're here, they exist.
Yeah.
And as our government, you have a duty unto them, you know? And like, you need to create a safe space for these children to come forward and be like, hey, this is how I feel, and this is what I'm going through, and this is the kind of support that I need. You know, like, every child is entitled to that. Every child.
You know, it's so sad as well, because they say history repeats itself, and it really does, because everyone is comparing this new legislation or proposed legislation to Section 28, which, for those who don't know, from the late 80s to the early 2000s, Section 28 was a piece of legislation, I think, brought in by Margaret Thatcher's government.
Of course.
That basically prohibited any kind of teaching or conversations in schools about homosexuality. So it basically meant that local authorities shall not intentionally promote homosexuality or publish material with the intention of promoting homosexuality or promote the teaching in any maintained school of the acceptability of homosexuality as a pretended family relationship. And a lot of people from the LGBTQ plus community who grew up, like, I think particularly like millennials or Generation X, that grew up during this time, like, were in school in, like,
this generational trauma.
Yeah,
like,
so they were in school, like, in the 90s, basically. They spoke about how, like, they might have been in school and, like, had questions about their sexuality, and they might have gone to teachers that they really felt comfortable with discussing, but the teachers, because of this legislation, they're not allowed to talk to them about it at all. They would just have to be like, they couldn't even say like, here are some resources about it. They literally have to be like, sorry, I can't have this conversation with you.
I really see it as, like, in my personal opinion, I really see it as a form of extremism. It's kind of like, you know how we spoke about having sex education with children doesn't mean you're showing them like a violent pornographic film, the same way that having a conversation about gender identity doesn't mean that you're then and they're gonna do gender reassignment surgery on them. You know, and I think that that's kind of like the line that people draw, and it's a sensationalist thing. It's a sensationalist response to like decades and decades of fear mongering. You know, like, it is as soon as a child opens up about potentially being confused about their gender identity, oh my God, that's it. Like, you know, we must, that means they're going to do gender reassignment surgery then and there. No, it's not. All you're doing is opening up a safe space for children to talk about what they're going through, which is literally your job as educators, as government officials. You know, schools have a pastoral care to children.
And again, this is why I mean, literally thing after thing after thing. I know you like tend to avoid seeing stuff on social media, but I don't suppose you've seen Rishi's appearance on Loose Women.
I scrolled.
Yeah.
They always do.
I mean, in terms of Loose Women, I have my various qualms with the show. I've not been a fan. I sometimes, like, it'll be on in like the TV and I'll just be sat there like major eye roll. I'm like, why, especially depending on the lineup as well, because obviously it's a revolving lineup, and especially depending on who's actually sat there and their social demographic, I'm sometimes a bit like, okay, why are these people discussing this issue sort of thing?
Kind
of vibe. But that being said, I was somewhat pleasantly surprised when I saw this clip of, well, I mean, first of all, there's the question as to why Rishi Sunak was appearing on Loose Women anyway. I don't really know what's going on there. But he was appearing on there earlier this week. No comment in Halima's opinion. He was speaking, and Judy Love was one of the members of the panel.
The clip that I saw was someone saying, like, it was a screenshot of her, like, rolling her eyes or something. That's what I saw.
Yeah, which is also funny because people, like, basically, it was the, was it the BAFTAs last week? Yeah, it was some kind of film awards, and Lorraine won something, and
it
panned onto Judy Love, but like she actually came out and said, no, it wasn't, he just panned onto me at the wrong moment. But everyone was like, because there's this whole thing on Twitter of Lorraine like not hosting their show. Have you seen that account? Basically, you know who Lorraine is, right?
Kind of, yeah.
She's like a TV host. She's on Before This Morning on ITV, right? Like every weekday. Well, she's meant to be, but there's this thing of like how last year.
Oh, she never shows up.
Yeah, last year especially, like, her attendance on her own talk show was just really poor, and, like, people are always stepping in promoting.
Oh, unless she won a BAFTA.
Yeah. So then people...
Must be nice.
Yeah, and people are always commenting, like, the show is literally called Lorraine, and, like, she's hardly there. So much to the extent that there's an account on Twitter solely dedicated to monitoring when she actually comes on her show. Oh, so every day they're like...
Has she come on?
Yeah, has she come on? And they're like, congrats, Lorraine, you came on today's show. Or it's like, Lorraine did not host the show today. It was instead hosted by blah, blah, blah. And there's a statistic at the end, like a percentage of the year of how many shows she's actually hosted. And currently we're like nearly 6 months in and she's on like 67%. Which isn't great when you think about it.
Gosh.
But it's
God,
just...
I see what you've done for others.
But it's just hilarious.
That kind of reward with that kind of work ethic. God, I see what you have done for others. That's my dream.
It is just hilarious that the fact that that account, and the account's got so many followers, and it's just really? Every single day just posting that. Anyway, long story cut short, Judy Love was part of the panel that was chatting to Rishi Sunak, and she didn't hold back. She was like, grilling him on these issues, largely revolving around housing. So she kept on asking him, for example, about people, NHS workers queuing for food banks, people living in homes of damp, like people are living in change. I think one of the things she said was like, I don't want to hear about what you're going to do. I want to know when you're going to do it, because I think that's like, people have been hearing promises for ages. They want to know when stuff is happening. And I watched this like 4 minute clip from it, and honestly, by about like a minute in, I was like, oh my gosh, like I actually can't watch this anymore, because I was feeling so much more cringe, like for Rishi Sunak, because he just kept on politician response.
Yeah.
He kept on talking about this online safety bill every time that Judy was asking about something, and she kept on coming back to it, and he just kept on talking about this. Different things.
What was the point of going on there?
Exactly. And the funniest bit was towards the end, she raised the point of, like, a lot of people feel you can't connect with them emotionally because you don't live the life that these people live.
Yeah.
What do you say to that? And he responded to that, like, I'd ask people to judge me by my actions.
That's
what I've done. That's who I am as a person. That's how I was raised. And her response to that was, how were you raised?
Yeah.
Like, if we're going to talk about that.
Dragged up, in my opinion.
So it was, like I say, it was pleasantly, especially seeing how in the past, like, 5 years, when it was the last general election and Boris Johnson went on this morning, compared to when Jeremy Corbyn went on, you obviously had Philip Schofield grilling Jeremy Corbyn, but then taking a selfie with Boris Johnson. It was pleasantly surprising for a change to see right-wing politicians being held to account live on TV.
But let it not be lost that it took a black woman to do that on national television.
Very true.
Let that not be lost.
Indeed. That's what I mean in terms of that. I have various eye rolls about it. But, yeah, Judy Love, keep doing what you're doing. Maybe consider a career change. I don't know.
Yourself in PMQs.
Yeah. The final thing, and this isn't even the final thing of Bad Vibes Island, this is just the final thing of the Tory party. Again, I don't think you will have seen this clip, but Suella Braverman went to Cambridge.
Oh!
Yeah, she went to Cambridge.
Oh, no. Don't say, I don't think you've seen this clip. I've watched it over and over and over again.
Okay, fair enough.
That one has really been, lifting my spirits.
Yes, it was just... That was an enjoyable clip to watch. For those who haven't seen it.
Very satisfying.
Suella Braverman, I think she was of GB News, maybe?
Yeah, she was, yeah.
She went to Cambridge, to the university, where obviously we know across the country at the moment, various protests and encampments are taking place in favour of a ceasefire and being pro-Palestine.
And once again, like, listen, full solidarity to these kids. Like, they are... amazing. The organization, the kind of level of conviction, commitment, like integrity that these student protesters have been showing. Like, I said it when we last spoke on the show, and I'll say it again, I am like honestly very, very impressed, very proud of all of these students that are taking part. And like, Carlos, go ahead.
Yeah, well, she basically turned up in Cambridge. I don't know why she was there, but she was with GB News.
No, you, like, she was there because GB News are kind of, in my opinion, a very inflammatory, you know, media platform. You know, they tend to kind of invite certain controversial figures and have very controversial discussions, for, in my opinion, just for outrage clicks, you know, more than any kind of meaningful dialogue or discussion. And that's
in my opinion, the culture war.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what Suella's visit was about. It was so funny because, like, I watched it. I watched the clip. And she's then, she's like, and obviously the presenter, he's like, oh, well, what are you here for? Blah, 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 blah. And she was like, I'm here to genuinely understand why these people are protesting. And it's like, anyone who knows anything about this woman, well, I'm going to have to phrase it as opinion, but in my opinion, that's not why she was there. She was there to... be antagonistic, to be patronizing, to basically denigrate the pro-Palestine cause. That's why she was there. And it shows so well, because then they went and did an interview on actual GB News. Have you seen?
What? No, it's just
with Fiona Lally. That the you haven't seen those clips? Oh no. My God, I've been reposting it on my TikTok. There's this girl... I believe she was a Cambridge student protester. Like, she's one of the organizers. And by the way, like, once again, this is why I say, when I say I really respect the integrity that these protesters have shown, because in America, over here, like all across the world, where these encampments are, obviously they've enacted a policy of like silence, of like they have designated speakers who will speak to the media, answer questions, have certain dialogues, and everybody else is there to show their support, and they're just completely refusing to speak
physical
to media people.
Physical solidarity.
Yeah,
basically.
I know, as soon as I see Suella, that's it, I'm finished. Me, I'm on that flight to Rwanda. Anyways, like, I would not have that level of self-control. I just would not, you know. It takes a lot of integrity and a lot of grace. And it's very, very powerful that they're doing it. Not only because when you watch that video, the reason I say, like, it's so internally satisfying is because she's there and you can tell she's trying to, like, gauge something from them. You know, Suella, in my opinion, is someone who, just looking at her, you could see the evil in her face, in my opinion, right? I think that you could just... You know, like Roald Dahl, like, wrote a quote where he was like, if you have bad thoughts, it will show on your face. Like, Suella, you could just tell from looking at her.
Halima's opinion.
I've said, in my opinion, what are you going to do? Anyways, my point is that she is there and you could tell she's trying to be, like, provocative. She has this air of, like, being condescending and being patronizing, and these students are just not giving her anything. And what it ends up doing is making her look very silly.
Well, I think that's the thing as well, when you're talking about her being, like, provocative or inflammatory or whatever, because these, basically, in case you haven't seen this clip and you haven't gathered yet, the main reason why this clip is so great is because she goes to speak to these protesters. She obviously is wanting to get something from them. She asks them questions. They just don't give anything. Silence.
Nothing.
No response. She proceeds to ask another question. Silence. And obviously, because they're not giving anything back, she's forced to ask the questions that she wants to ask.
Right.
But it makes it sound so much more ridiculous because you're seeing how
you're talking
asking
to
these questions. Exactly.
Yeah. Like, and you see the progression of, like, just how ridiculous it's getting. And, like, people were saying, like, silence cannot be misquoted. And that is perfect, because we know kind of, you know, the mainstream media, whose side they're on, and we know how their reporting of pro-Palestinian protests has been very, very skewed and biased and things like that. And these students have really taken that in their stride. And not only is it a great form of, like, protecting themselves, but it also, as we're saying, makes the opposition, makes the other people look very, very silly, you know, which... in the case of Suella, for me personally, was very satisfying. But then what they did was they went on GB News and they got one of these, like, representatives, these speaker, you know, organizers to actually go on. And she's, like, a very, very eloquent girl. Like, her name is Fiona Lally. I literally tweeted, like, who is she? I want to give her a kiss on the forehead. Like, she, the way she spoke to Suella was honestly.
She actually spoke to Suella.
She did
it.
She did it. This one, her.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that.
Really? It's all over my TikTok. Every other video on my TikTok is this girl. Mm. So she, it was fantastic. Like, Suella is there. Suella is asking her, you know, as kind of the people who are on the side of, you know, Israel, how they, you know, how their regular talking points. What about Hamas? Do you condemn Hamas? Do you think Hamas are a terrorist group? What about October the 7th? Do you have any sympathy for October the 7th? And blah, 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 blah. And she's trying, you could tell Suella is trying so hard to bring this girl into this kind of like emotional fray of the conversation to get her to like shout at her or to talk to her sideways or to have an emotional reaction. And this girl is so composed and she literally is like, this is not what the encampment is about. The encampment is not about October the 7th. It's about 76 years now of the Nakba. It's about, you know, Israel committing a genocide. And what's so great is that she talks directly, you know, like, she kind of gives kind of politician style answers. Suella will be like, what do you think about Hamas as a terrorist organization? Then the girl will be like, well, let's talk about what everyone thinks about you. Like, you know, this is the case in the UK. Like, people are suffering from this, from this, from this, from this. You're creating a culture war. You're doing this. You're doing that. This protest, it's going to take you down. It's going to take the Tories down. Blah, 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 blah. She's so composed when she's saying it. And you can see.
I need to
see,
go and watch
you
this.
Need to. And yeah. You can see Suella, like, visibly, like, kind of getting very uncomfortable. And she outright says, like, you're a war criminal to Suella.
Mm.
Which, you know, really, really kudos to the girl. She did a great job.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have been able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like you'd be able to say it, but then if you're sat, you'd be able to make all the right... I mean, on the show, obviously, we're well aware of you being very eloquent and being able to make a lot of points, but I feel like if Suella was sat across from us now, I don't know how
mm-mm.
that was.
I don't believe in bigger personism. I will never be the bigger person. That girl, she was being the bigger person. But she was doing it in a way where she was still undermining Suella. That's why I'm like, I have a lot of respect for her because me, I can't keep composure.
Yeah, and it's one of the things that makes you think that, you know, the kids are all right.
The kids are all right, yeah. Bro. The kids are all right, you know, they're more than all right.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break from the bad, bad vibes island on politics. Move over to the royal family. Seeing Charles's new portrait.
Someone was like, I mean, I can say this on air, right?
Well, I can't read your mind.
Someone was like, I can't say this on air. Someone was like, oh, he's finally become the tampon that he wanted to
be
so badly.
Someone said
that. I don't know who, but someone said that. I thought that was quite funny. What is that about? Like, what is going on there?
Yeah, I'm kind of in two minds because on the one hand, I'm like, this is hilarious. Well, on the other side, I'm like, but also, how has this happened? For those who haven't seen the portrait, I don't know how you haven't. It's the first official portrait of King Charles since his coronation. I think it was unveiled to him as well. Like,
yeah, he unveiled.
Yeah,
it.
Like he didn't see it before that. And it's basically the portrait of him is like whatever, but then it's his surrounding is just completely red, and it's just very much. It's very red. That's the main thing.
He's red.
Yeah,
he's red. Everything is red. Like. It's just like a background of red. His clothes are painted in shades of red to the point where it kind of obscures into the background and then it's just his face.
Yeah.
Which is...
I mean, I've got the artist's... What the artist is trying to get across is. So he said, first of all, the little bit of detail in it is there's a butterfly there, like, above him. And I think he said that in history of art, the butterfly symbolizes metamorphosis and rebirth. So obviously that's representing his ascension to the throne. It's also a reference to his held interest in the environment, because we obviously know that he is a big anti-climate change and like pro-environment spokesperson. But the red is apparently because the artist wanted to inject a dynamic contemporary jolt into the genre with its uniformly powerful hue, providing a modern contrast to more traditional depictions. So I'm just like...
I'm just not one to comment on this because people's characterization of our king is not my own characterization of arcing, and I'll just leave it at that.
But is it though? Because people have pointed out that like the red around it
makes him look very bloody, right?
People are saying perfectly summarizes the bloody legacy of the United Kingdom and its monarchy and the British Empire. So,
do you reckon like the artist kind of, it was like a intentional sabotage?
I don't know, but I'm also like, this is what I don't understand, because if the royal family are commissioning you to do a portrait, which I'm presuming is what's happened.
They would have vetted it.
Yeah.
They would have vetted it before revealing it to the public, and if they thought like sideways about it, they just would have been like, no, we're not putting this forward.
But I don't get how you don't look at that and think sideways about it, because I was just like...
Well, that's my point, is because they don't have the same characterization of themselves as we do.
What, you think they generally look to them and are like, well, cool?
I don't think they think of themselves as like as the legacy of the monarchy as being bloodthirsty. Yeah. I don't think they see it like that.
Yeah. Well, apparently Camilla thought that it captured him well, and Charles was a bit taken aback by the red, but was like, oh, it's very good.
Good for you, Charles.
Yeah, but
I don't have anything else to say on that.
I just yeah. Munya's already done a funny sketch about it. We should go and watch that.
That man, his pen is phenomenal.
His
pen is phenomenal. That is a man that he deserves way more than he has. What was that camera gone?
Yeah, it's fine. Give Munya a bit more hype.
I love him. I think, you know what? Like, you know when he does his MCing, like when he writes raps and stuff. He's actually really, really good. Like, his penmanship is actually phenomenal. And he's so witty and like, also so funny at the same time. But the thing is that I think, you know what? Like, he's going to be, like, a source on, like, a GCSE question in, like, 50 years' time, because his political critique is so deft. Mm. Like, it is so, so, like, succinct. And he does it with such like humor and such contemporary cultural relevance. Mm.
Big up Munya.
You know, for real talk, big up Munya.
Yeah. Going back to some more bad British vibes. Have you seen the story? It is never ending. I'm sorry, it is. Have you seen the story about the Ghanaian man living in the Wirral? No.
The one who's getting deported.
Well, he's not getting deported.
He needs to produce documents that he doesn't have. Yeah, I have.
So basically...
Did I send that?
I think I saw
it. You know what's so funny? You know what's so funny? Wallahi, hand on my heart. Is that I saw briefly like the headlines, and I thought to myself, like, oh, let me send this to our group. Because like throughout the week, we'll send each other things to be like, oh, we should discuss this, blah, 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 blah. And like, I was going to send it to the group chat to be like, let's discuss this. And then I thought, wait, it's enough. I thought, wait, hang on, I've already sent a few things this week. And I'll be like, it's too much.
It's overload, God. Honestly, it is. But you're just keeping this brief, because I don't think there's anything more in this that we can necessarily add. But basically, Nelson Shardy, he's from the Wirral. He has assumed that he's British, like, all his life, because he came over in 1977 to study accountancy. He has children here. He's a married British woman. He only discovered that he's actually not British in 2019, despite having paid taxes all his life. And now he's having to jump through all the legal, logistical hoops.
What do we mean by he realised he's not British, as in he doesn't have a passport?
I think that it's that he wants to... I'm not really sure what... Oh, yes. In 2019, he applied for a passport so he could go back to Ghana following the death of his mother. And he was told, actually, you're not British. You don't have any right to be here. Despite having been here for 50 years, having paid taxes, and also now I think he wants to, he's obviously getting older, he wants to obviously make use of the NHS and continue to be here.
So how is this man paying taxes?
That's what I don't understand.
And they've not clocked on their system, this is he's not here.
Yeah. Like, how? Yeah, how? And I'm kind of like, okay, fair.
If he's not a British citizen... then he's not on their system. So where has this man's money gone?
Very good question. And it's also kind of like, well, if you've been paying taxes all this time and now you're going to turn around and say, actually, you're not British, can he get a refund, please?
No, no. Either give the man his passport quickly and shut your mouth, or give him a refund.
Well, this is the thing. Despite him having been here for so long, he's married a British woman. He's had kids here. He is still having to follow a 10-year process for settlement.
That's insane.
So he's going to be 84 by the time that he actually gets this.
And that's insane.
I think there's not much more to add here, but I think they are taking it forward as a legal case. So I don't want to like disrupt
any of
that. No,
I really hope that they do. And this is like, by the way, not a uncommon thing. Like, there have been so many examples, particularly people of like the Windrush generation, where they kind of came over where their parents, you know, at the time of empire, their parents were still classed as British subjects, you know, which is another funny thing about just anything to do with British citizenship. Like, you lot made a quarter of the world British subjects before any of these people ever set foot on British soil. That's crazy. That's crazy.
That's on you.
It's like four generations of my family were British subjects before any of us like ever actually set foot on British soil. That's crazy. So, you know, in the Windrush period, like, they gave these people from the, you know, the Caribbean, like, invitation to come to Britain, obviously to rebuild the country. And because they were British subjects, they didn't need any particular immigration documents. They ended up having kids here and things like that. And then they turn around and be like, oh, no, actually, you don't have the right documents. We're going to send you back to your home country. Countries that these people had never lived in. They don't know. They're not familiar. They might not even have any contacts. Like, it's a well-documented, like, phenomenon within our immigration system, which is just ridiculous. What does it mean to be British? Like, the one thing that people will be like, I pay my taxes. I have a right to be here. This man has been paying his taxes. And also, like, I find it very hard to believe that this man is paying his taxes and he's not like registered on the system. I don't understand how that works.
I mean, best believe if he'd got into any kind of
trouble,
I bet then it would have come up.
All of a sudden, when you're getting money, then all of a sudden, like, guys, I lived in Longside. I can't tell you how many immigration raids I saw. Them man are on it. They are on it. Like, I'm not even exaggerating. Like, immigration raids are very, very common thing in this country. This is not, I don't personally believe that it's an accident. And let's give the benefit of the doubt. If it is an accident and it was like a clerical error, how broken is our system that something like this is allowed to happen? You know?
And I think there's also a human element to it as well that is obviously completely missing. And it's the fact that someone can be living here for 50 years, be married to a British person, have kids.
They've set up home here. This is
their life. This is literally their life. And yet they're told, well, if you go back to Ghana to visit your family or whatever, you can't come back. Despite you... Again, he's been here for 50 years. He is 70. He's lived here for the vast majority of his life. And yet...
But that's what they do. Like, yeah. they will, like, with the Windrush scandal, like, they're literally sending people back home who had absolutely no connections to the Caribbean, you know? But because their parents came from them on the invitation or even the request of the British government, now all of a sudden that's where they belong. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, speaking of going global, taking a bit of a risk here, but going over to India. PJ.
Very risky. I would know. Goodness.
Yeah. Modi has been in the news recently. Obviously, the elections are ongoing. I think the results of it are coming out in beginning of June, in which he potentially, or probably most likely, by the way things are going, is going to get elected for a third term, which is quite rare, apparently, in Indian politics. That being said...
How is that allowed?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's allowed here, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I just don't think that. Yeah. I just don't think it should be. I think that there should be like a,
like America.
Like a two-term limit, because feasibly, like, we could have the same leader for God knows how many years.
It does lend itself to dictatorship, doesn't it?
You get.
Yeah, but basically, he's in the news because of comments that he made last month. So in a speech last month, Modi said that Congress, who are BJP's main opposition, he said that their election manifesto promises to confiscate and redistribute the wealth of Indians, Congress has denied this. Modi said that if the party adhered to remarks in 2006 by then Congress Prime Minister Singh, that minority Muslims should have the first claim on resources to share in the fruits of development, then wealth would be distributed to quote-unquote infiltrators and those who have more children. Now, Modi has come forward like and referred to this because obviously when he said infiltrators, everyone was up in arms like, how are you call? People took from that, you are calling Muslims infiltrators, and you're obviously referring to them. How can you say that? He claims he hasn't mentioned Hindu or Muslims. I am targeting parties that are destroying India's secularism. And I think it's so interesting.
Oh my God, I can't even be bothered.
It's so interesting to see
The delusion.
The BJP as...
The level of gaslighting.
The BJP as an obviously Hindu nationalist party.
Talk about secularism.
Yeah, their whole thing is promoting themselves as the secular saviours of India, which is meant to be a secular country. It's not meant to be Hindu or Muslim state. It is meant to be secular. Their whole thing is promoting this idea of, oh, we're making things secular again. Meanwhile, in the reality of it is obviously he gets away with making comments like that and just saying, well, I never mentioned Hindu or Muslim, so...
It's absolutely like, it is a level of gaslighting that is bordering, if it wasn't so dangerous, bordering on impressive. Like you have created an absolute kind of epidemic of like Hindu nationalism that is a... Like, it is a huge threat to democracy. Mm. It is a huge threat to human rights. It is a huge threat to liberty and freedom in India. And this is extremely well documented. Extremely, extremely well documented. And to come here now and be like, to completely untether your party from this kind of, you know, reality and to say, no, we are the promoters and the custodians of secularism. When the reason why you're there is because you've stoked so much Hindu nationalist like sentiment.
Exactly. Like 5 years ago when the last elections were happening, part of their manifesto was obviously promoting this Citizenship Amendment Act, which for those who don't know is basically they want to allow the fast tracking of citizenship for basically any religion, pretty much apart from Muslims, from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan. And obviously critics have said that this law is discriminatory because it excludes Muslims and applies a religious criteria for the first time to the question of citizenship. Modi's come back and said that it's designed to provide protection for vulnerable religious minorities who faced persecution in these three Muslim-majority countries. And it's so mad because you're putting under the guise of, oh, we're taking minorities from these Muslim-majority countries.
Sorry, are you Batman? Like, is that who you think you are? But it's crazy.
But then when it comes to Muslim minorities in your country, you stoke the flames of, like, oh, but Congress wants to give all the resources to the minorities. We don't want to do that. And again, I heard a very good point the other day. Countries like Pakistan, I'm sure Bangladesh as well. I'm not sure actually Bangladesh because of the population size, but Pakistan definitely. Pakistan as a Muslim country has less Muslims than India does in total.
India has the most. India has like maybe the second or third most Muslims in the world.
Yes, Muslims might be a minority in India, but then you're going on about like these countries, but they're actually, you have more Muslims than they do.
Yeah. So, like numerically, yeah. I don't know. I find it really, to me personally, India is just like a very scary, very insane place. We've seen the fallout of Islamophobia, to be honest, all up and down the country. Like, there are first-hand testimonies and videos. It is so all you need to do is look. It is so well documented, the kind of level of Islamophobia that has been rife under Modi's premiership. I'm talking about public lynchings, people being, trigger warning, people being like hung from trees, people literally just being murdered and beat up just indiscriminately in the street.
Largely in the wake of when Modi releases his plans to or enforces new legislation. So it's when these people feel emboldened that they're then going and doing this.
Like Islamophobia, people would think is like a permanent fixture of like India's national culture, you know, like, and it is every facet of Indian society is like absolutely poisoned with it, you know, housing, education, employment, every it is so well documented. As I say, all you need to do is look. So for him to now come now and kind of like completely deny the charge, completely deny the accusations and go the opposite way where he claims to be the custodian of secularism, when, as I said, the only reason he has the power and the position he has now is because he's manipulated Hindu nationalist sentiment, is, as I say, a level of gaslighting that is extremely masterful. I don't know for India, bruv. Like, I'm just so... I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know...
Yeah.
It is very depressing. It's very disheartening.
Well, going back to the UK and more depressing stuff, you posted this on the chat, and we did mention this briefly when it happened, but I think it's received attention recently because it's been on the news, but... obviously, in November, when there was one of the many pro-Palestine marches, protests that have happened, a woman who is a teacher, or was a teacher, held up a placard that had a picture of a coconut tree. It depicted Rishi and Suella as being coconuts. The thing that we raised when we talked about this before was how... vastly inappropriate it was of the Met Police to release that photo on their own social media and basically ask the public to do a manhunt for this woman. That's aside from the fact of whether or not you think that the term coconut or that poster was offensive, though obviously we've talked again, in our opinion, definitely not offensive. But it's the fact that they then enacted a public manhunt for this woman who has been abused, harassed, forced, literally, and also like just interrogated by the Met Police over a poster that...
No, guys, like it's really, really, really bad. Like I'm gonna find what they've done to this woman is like they've... I don't know if it how arbitrary, how like it seems very arbitrary. They've kind of like chosen this example of this woman and they've made a complete example out of her. There was a person who did like a long thread about what had happened. Wait, let me try and find it. Did I send the group chat?
It's Mariah Hussein, I think her name is.
Hang on, let me see, because this person talks about... there we go. It's someone called Nels Abbey. He has a thread. Guys, I didn't sleep properly last night. He has a thread on... Thread. Wow. He has a thread on Twitter, not a thread. He has a thread on Twitter, basically, where he details what had happened to this woman. And he talks about how, obviously, the Met Police shared her picture to 1.3 million followers. She lost her job. They aggressively questioned her under caution, which obviously is very, very... Like they use, like, intimidation, basically. They used social media of other ethnic minorities as proof that what she had said was racist, which, by the way, I want to come and, like, discuss later on. They showed up to her house. After the questioning, they showed up to her house at 2:30 a.m., aggressively banged on her door and shouted for her to open up as she lay in bed, petrified, then left her in limbo for over 6 months. So what they've done is, on a whim, this was on the day of the protest, they posted her picture. They'd said that kind of this is like racial hatred, this is racism, whatever.
She's wanted on suspicion of...
Exactly. And now, obviously, because they've made such a public spectacle of it, they can't back down. They're doubling down now. So what they have done, according to this person, is that they've now gone on a kind of search for other ethnic minorities who will concur that what she said was racial hatred, which is insane to go to that level of like punishment already, and you don't have a kind of established, mandated, ratified political instrument wherein what she says or what she's, you know, written is definitively categorized as racial hatred, making up this law as you go along, finding consensus for your unilateral and arbitrary like decision and punishment as you go along. What kind of law and order is that?
It's not.
It's not. Moreover, if you want to have the debate about whether what she said is political hatred or not, because I've seen some people, like, and what's so funny as well is that these are all non-Desi people. Mm. Like, I've seen some non-Desi people come forward and be like, no, 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 it's hate speech. It's hate speech. You know, like, she's basically making hateful and derogatory comments on the basis of race and ethnicity. And it's like, okay, cool. In that regard, yes, I get it. However, there is a difference between hate speech and political critique. What she did is political critique, and the law should be able to account for that level of like
nuance.
Exactly. The law should be able to kind of account for that insight. You know, if because if you look at it's an intra-community term. It is an intra-community term. It's a term that South Asians use for each other. People are now going to be like, okay, well, there's no one way to perform South Asianness. No, there isn't. But we are a demographic. We are a demographic. And we are allowed to have a political critique, you know? And if that's a term that signals something much bigger and deeper and much more complex.
I think there's a difference as well between being called a coconut because you like listening to country music,
you
for example,
get.
Being called a coconut because you are in a position of power.
You are aiding and abetting genocide.
Yeah.
That's my point. It's a political critique. It's not a personal sentiment. It's not like, oh, it's because I dislike you. It's because I fundamentally disagree with your actions, especially from the insight of a South Asian who is an ethnic minority in this country and should therefore be privy to systems of white supremacy and racism, which are well-established, well-documented, objective facts of British society. You know, that is a political critique. Mm-hmm. It's not personal sentiment. It's not personal opinion. Well, I guess all political critique is opinion, but whatever. Yeah. You know, and the fact that the Met are scrabbling to find people to agree with this just goes to show, like, they acted completely on a whim. What they need to pay that woman compensation and reparations and issue a public apology. That's what the Met need to do. It's absolutely abhorrent the way that they treated her. And actually, fundamentally, I see it as an attack on, like, free speech. I really sound like a right wing, but I do. It is, you know, because you know what's so worrying about this is that that's the kind of comment that any of us would kind of make.
Yeah.
You know, like offhandedly, any of us would make that kind of comment.
Yeah.
You know,
I think this is the thing. It's the way that we've been pleading for there to be sufficient and to be taken seriously when it comes to racial hatred and that sort of thing. And now it's like actual race hate laws being used to actually and being weaponized against ethnic minorities.
It's so funny because it reminds me of, you know, when we had Moss, the Bengali filmmaker, on the show, and he told us about this story about his friend who got done under prevent, which is obviously the law where you get to kind of like caution or whatever people who are suspected of extremism. And usually it's been used disproportionately against Muslim people under the accusation of Islamist extremism. But with his friend, they got him under prevent on the accusation of right wing extremism. And it's like, you lot are so desperate to get us that you'll just be throwing any charge anyhow. Like you don't care where on the spectrum it falls, as long as you get to use the charge to get us. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Anyway, free that woman, man. Free her.
Yeah.
Let her go.
Yeah. I also wanted to touch on this week, because I've seen it, a particular rise on my feed in terms of both anti-Semitism and also planned anti-Semitism attacks that have been thwarted. So first of all, there was a attack in France where an Algerian man set a synagogue on fire. he was appealing against an order to leave France, which obviously that's separate to the issue, but the fact is he still chose to set fire to a synagogue, which, again, like, I don't know, I don't really understand what setting fire to a synagogue has in terms of how that's going to aid your case. Surely it should be...
You know what it is? It's like, oh my God, and I'll speak on this, like, from the perspective of a Muslim. Some, obviously, like, the pro-Palestine cause has seen kind of global international spotlight in the past 6 months, but it is a conversation that a lot of Muslims have been very privy to, and a political cause that a lot of Muslims have put their weight behind long, long, long before. And unfortunately, there are some Muslims who are like, just kind of don't really have two brain cells to rub together and see this as an issue of like Jews versus Muslims. And it would then kind of stoke anti-Semitism in certain factions, you know, of our community, which is like, as I said, like, I beg, just two brain cells, rub them together, and like logic will appear to you, and you'll realize that it's not an issue of like Jews versus Muslims. It is, we are standing decisively against the Israeli state. The Jewish people are on our side. As Muslims, we should have a deep kind of reverence for Jewish people as people of the book. You know, like, we are supposed to respect them and honor them and kind of protect them and build community with them in particular. You know, so people who are kind of seeing what's going on in Israel and letting that translate into a blanket hate for all Jewish people, like, it's very silly. It's a very, very silly thing to do. Like, a synagogue is a place of worship. It is a kind of, sanctuary. Wow. It's a sanctuary. It's a holy place. And we as Muslims, more than anyone, should respect that and should, in turn, like, we should be the ones defending synagogues from anti-Semitic attacks. We shouldn't be the one doing them, you know? Yeah. Like, that is not what Islam teaches us. Islam teaches us, as I say, to honour and to revere.
Exactly, and it's the fact that... So I saw that, first of all. Then I saw a video of a woman in London who was carrying a really large knife. She was arrested for, obviously, possession of an offensive weapon. This was in North London. And she allegedly told a Jewish man that he is a provocation before specifying, what? You people, you Jewish, all the trouble you're creating in the world. When asked what she meant, she allegedly replied, who do you think started the Second World War?
My
you,
God.
The Jewish, started the Second World War.
Who was this woman? What was her background? Do you know?
I don't know off the top of my head. I can get that now, but...
No, I'm just wondering if it was like a Muslim, because I was just going to be like, for God's sake, can't be bothered.
For some reason, I do seem to remember... actually, I've got it here. I feel like she had...
Was she wearing hijab?
She's wearing something on her head, though. I don't know.
You can't really tell.
You can't really tell.
But anyways, it doesn't matter, because that is like a ridiculous, ridiculous claim to make.
Yeah,
like...
it's so... It's ridiculous. It's insensitive.
Like, it's harmful. Yeah. Like we are taught like a lot about what the Holocaust was and what the Holocaust did and the kind of generational trauma that the Jewish community around the world are still reeling from. To sit there and kind of victim blame is, I can't understand it.
Yeah. And the final thing was, in Manchester, three men appeared in court charged with terrorism offences over an alleged plan for a gun attack targeting the Jewish community in the northwest of England.
I just don't, like, what war do you lot think you're fighting, like, in Manchester and in France and in bloody London or whatever? Mm. Like, I don't understand, like, if the reason why you're... displaying and engaging in like anti-Semitic behavior is because, you know, oh, it's for Palestine, like, what, like, how does that help the cause of does that help the Palestinian cause? Like, all you're doing is detracting from it. All you're doing is kind of justifying people dismissing it as a violent extremist movement, which everyone else is working really hard to kind of undo that perception, you know? Like, you, it's not your personal opinions, your personal beliefs, your personal feelings don't matter. What's important here is the cause of Palestinian liberation. This, on a level, doesn't help that. Like just to work on your logic, like, it doesn't help that cause. Not that you can rationalize that kind of behavior anyway, you know? Like, yeah. even if, you know, stabbing a Jewish person would help the cause somehow, like, you just shouldn't.
Yeah.
You just shouldn't. But by your logic, it's not helping your cause.
Yeah. So just what, obviously, like the fact that those three events happened in the space of a week in Europe, I was just like, yeah, like it's clear that like we've been known that obviously both is Islamophobic and anti-Semitic.
It's just awful. It's so awful. Like we kind of see these issues as being so self-contained to the region, and obviously, yes, like it's the Palestinians that are the first and foremost kind of victims, but the global reverberations that something like that has, you know, on communities that are adjacent to the people in the region is. It's crazy. It's insane.
Yeah. So there's solidarity with anyone in the Jewish community who is feeling unsafe at the moment, because it's perfectly understandable why you would feel that way. And yeah, anyone who is doing these attacks or planning these attacks, please, like Alina says, find two brain cells to run.
You know what? Like, speaking of France, I want to kind of talk very briefly about, because you know me, I love to talk smack on France. I want to talk very briefly about what's happening in New Caledonia. So for people who don't know, New Caledonia is a Pacific island, and it is like a French overseas territory, basically. Like it is what you would call a colony, but kind of in, I guess, it's like neo-colonialism, you know, essentially. Like and we have seen, obviously, last year and this year, a wave of kind of like continued decolonization all over like West Africa from ex-French colonies that were still, I would call, kind of, you know, as I say, neo-colonies. Niger, Burkina Faso, those countries. And kind of, I would say, on the same wave of that, there have been kind of insurgents on New Caledonia. So New Caledonia, the kind of demographics are largely like indigenous Melanesian people who are indigenous to the island. And then there are also kind of like settlers. So a lot of Europeans, obviously a lot of French people that have gone and settled on the islands, as people do on colonies. And there have been recent insurgents. And one tool that the like kind of people, the insurgents have been using is TikTok as a tool to organize and spread awareness of their message. Obviously, they're fighting for a free, you know, New Caledonia. And France, what they have done is they have banned TikTok in the country because the organizers are using it as a tool to spread awareness and to organize kind of insurgencies, sorry. So France have banned TikTok, and also I believe yesterday or the day before there was a clash between like the protesters and the French authorities, and a number of indigenous New Caledonian people were killed by French troops, which is obviously like extremely sad to see. It is oppressive on the behalf of like the French state, in my opinion. There is absolutely no reason why France should have any control or any say or any hand in any of the matters of an island that is however many thousand miles away from where they are, you know, as a colonial continuity. The reason you have any control of New Caledonia is as a colonial continuity is because you were once they were once your colonies, and you kind of, you know, just loosening the strings a little bit doesn't necessarily mean that they are no longer your colony. And the people who are fighting for a free New Caledonia, like, all my solidarity with them. I hope that they are successful and fruitful in their fight. Free New Caledonia.
Yeah. Right, well, into less than 10 minutes left. It's been a very long, talky episode, but nevertheless, got through some very important issues and all the depressing things that are going on in the world at the moment. So, to finish with, let's do a little bit of a positive spin. Cool. Obviously, it's mid-May, wedding season is upon us, fast approaching. We've got a few lined up, one of which we are together. So
oh,
be nice.
Yeah, exciting, very exciting.
That being said, you sent a TikTok the other day that was basically... it's a debate that I think is common amongst all cultures, really. I think I've seen a lot.
No,
actually,
no. This is the conversation that I wanted to have.
Well, the thing is, it's a debate, but also obviously, like, I think it's a debate, but I think in other cultures, it's more likely to be like go one way than the other. So this woman was basically she was on the call to someone and was basically saying, the person on the phone was like, oh, can I bring my kids to your wedding? She was like, no. She's like, oh, but they're really well behaved, this, that, the other. She's like, well, no, it's a no kids event. Now, the Halima sent this, like, we need to debate this, especially as you've had a wedding, like, last year. And I was like, okay. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, I think ultimately it's fine for people to say that, but like you're about to say, I think, well, go on.
Yeah, I think it's entirely the couple's prerogative. Like, no one can actually take away from that. Ultimately, what it comes down to, it is your wedding. It is your prerogative. And if you want a child-free wedding, that's entirely, entirely on you. Me, however, I have a very different perspective on it. And I think that's why when Carlos was like, oh, I think it's a conversation in all cultures, I was like, hell no. Like, this is not even a consideration in any Bengali wedding culture, household, community. Like, it is so beyond the fray of, like, what is possible, what is, like, imaginable to Bengalis. Like, and I do think there is a very, very clear kind of cultural difference. I do think that, obviously, there's already a cultural difference in terms of, like, we can speak from the perspective of Desi weddings, for example. Desi weddings and, like, this person was a white British person. So, like, you know, Western weddings and, like, Desi weddings at large, there's obviously a big, big, big cultural difference. For us, for Desi weddings, our weddings are, they are massive, and not just necessarily because, like, oh, people love to show off and blah, 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 blah. But so much of it is kind of, it's a time and opportunity to kind of, like, give back to your community, to, like, feed people. For example, like, when I was having a conversation with my dad about how big my wedding would be, and I was like, oh, Baba, like, it's not, like, it can't be that big. It's too big, blah, 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 blah. My dad was like, you guys are selfish. You guys have no sense of community feel. You have no sense of community value. Like, it's a good chance to feed people, to bring people together, to give back to people, and you're saying you don't want to do that. And obviously I'm there rolling my eyes, but slyly he has a point. I mean, I do think there should still be a limit, but like, he has a point, you know, like, it is part of our culture to be hospitable, to host people, to share our joy with our wider community. And that kind of culture is not as resonant in the Western cultures, where they tend to have smaller weddings, where it tends to be kind of closer people and things like that. And I think that really kind of extends into this debate about kids or not, because I would think that in Desi weddings, especially, I can talk like with 100% certainty with Bengali weddings, that would never be a consideration, because we don't ever restrict. Like, when we write our wedding invitations, we don't do RSVP. We don't even do RSVP. We just say to so-and-so and family. People could rock up with two people, or they could rock up with 20 people. Logistically, cool. It might not be great, but that's how we do things. And I think that there's a real beauty to that. There is something so valuable in that. And that's why our communities, we have such strong community spirit. You know, that's why we have such strong camaraderie and kinship in our communities, you know, because we keep cultural practices like this alive. And I think, like, to just have a blanket rule, and this is my opinion, but just have a blanket rule to be like, oh, no kids allowed, like, it's sad, because it kind of, like, it takes, because what the cousin was saying, she was like, you know, you spend so much time with my kids, like, they're so excited, they want to share this day with you. And I think that's actually really grim. Like, if you're spending so much time with these kids and, like, you're close with them, they also want to share in your big day. You know, like, you're kind of like excluding them from what is a family, well, I mean, your event, but it is a family event as well, you know.
It really does depend on context, doesn't it? I mean, one thing that comes to mind as well is, I think, thinking about things, one of the main reasons why people don't like to have kids at weddings is also because they want it to be, for a lot of events, they want it to be a massive drinking fest and, like, to have a fun, inebriated time, which, when I'm thinking about Muslim weddings, I'm thinking, wow, that's not even a question.
Yeah,
I think that also is, like, maybe a reason why, because I was thinking about our wedding, for example. I think we were, like, from the get-go, like, just, like, well, where possible, just not really keen on kids. Because we don't think about it. It's weird. Like, we don't really know that many, like, kids.
No, if it's, like, random people bringing their random snotty nephew, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
This is her niece,
yeah,
who she spends a lot of time with.
Yeah, like I said, it's dependent on context. Because for us, I think the majority of kids there were... Or there were only a couple of kids... Well, actually, the only couple of kids planned to be there were kids that had come from a different... country, and therefore that wasn't like their parents gonna whip out.
Like, if
money
you had
to,
a
like,
kid cousin, if you had a kid cousin, would you be like, nah, you can't come?
No,
like, well, yeah,
exactly. That's the thing. That wasn't
like your wedding. You had, like, I'm talking about an extreme case where Bengalis don't do any planning or any RSVP. Anyone's welcome. But in your wedding, you had, like, people you knew who was coming.
Yeah,
and you wouldn't not extend an invitation to a kid in the family or a family friend or whatever because they're a kid.
Yeah. Also, the people like. Half of the kids that were, like, actually like, okay, yeah, cool, like, come to the wedding, they actually didn't end up coming to the reception because they were so tired from having gone to everything
so
the rest of the time.
So that's what I was about to say as well. Like, if you want it to be, like, a grown-up party where you can have booze and all these things, you could do it where it's like, okay, maybe they can come to, like, the reception and not the party, or, like, maybe they can put, like, a curfew. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many compromises that can be made to include these people in your family who obviously really want to be there. Like, you know, like, you could say, like, you could be there for the sit-down dinner and then say the wedding is going on till 12 p.m. At 9 p.m., like, you know, we kind of expect the kids to be escorted out or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's so fair. I do think that this you know, any wedding, and this is my personal opinion, because I am somebody who, if it wasn't obvious, I'm extremely community minded. I'm extremely, like, family oriented. So for me, I see it, and I'm very deeply connected to everyone around me. I see it as, like, an example of Western individualism. Like, that is just what I see. You know, I hate this kind of phenomenon of Western individualism, like, and I think that it is a cornerstone of, like, Western culture. You know, I think it's very sad. It's very, like, it's just very sad, me personally. That's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, me on the flip side of that, I think having, like, grown up in a largely, like, Westernized household, and also being someone that enjoys their own company a lot, I'm kind of like, I find it a lot easier to kind of be like, if whatever the couple wants, just go with that. Like,
yeah, obviously it is ultimately everyone's prerogative. I do just think it's an example of Western individualism, in my opinion.
I'm quite happy to be individual, to be honest.
Gosh.
On that note, can you leave?
But it's also like the community that you're tethered to, because the conversation isn't that let's just invite anyone anyhow. Do you know what I mean? Like, you extended your invitation to people who were part of your world, your family, your family friends. This woman is excluding her niece. Do you know what I mean? Like, these are like, it's not, the conversation isn't like, oh, should we just invite strangers? The conversation is, even our own family members who are kids, we're not going to have, which I do think is a bit selfish, but, you know, it's your wedding, do what you want.
Yeah. I think... To summarize the question, would you have kids at your wedding? You're clearly saying yes.
You lot, dad, if my dad could have it his way, how many followers do we have? 3,000 something. My dad would invite all 3,000 something people to my wedding if he could have it his way.
Nearly at 4K, you know.
Nearly at 4K, come on.
You know, like, it was like at the start of the year, like, was it either you or Simran was like, oh, 4K by summer, like,
inshallah.
as a joke, and it's like, actually might happen, so.
Wow.
You'll see.
I'm going to wake up on £5 million will be my bank account tomorrow. Ha ha, just joking. That would be nice.
I hope you would donate a lot of that, Halima.
I would.
Yeah, I have no doubt about it.
I would.
Right, well, thank you everyone for tuning in today.
We should actually have a conversation about how we would spend if we won the lottery. That could be like a fun conversation.
Yeah, we'll do that. Maybe we should do that when Simran's here next week.
Yeah,
something to look forward to.
Exciting.
Yeah, so we will see you then. I'm really hungry now.
I'm starving. I'm literally. Yeah. I was texting my family about, like, what we're going to eat. What are we about to eat at?
Right, where's this?
Right, thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you next week. Bye.